White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to episode 3 of the International Jew Study Hour on July 12th, 2012. This is a 12-12 day. 7-12-12. Okay. I am Carolyn Yeager with my co-host, Hadding Scott. And tonight we're going to cover chapter 2, which is Germany's reaction against the Jew. You know, Hadding, listening, every time I hear that music opening up, it puts me into a really good mood. I mean, really, it just makes me feel happy. So I remember on the first program, you saying that if you can fiddle, you don't need TV. I said, well, gee, how entertaining is it to just fiddle? But at least it makes you feel happy and put you in a good mood, I'd say that.
Yeah.
So, it's real upbeat to me. I love it. So, okay, yeah. Do you have anything to say about any opening remarks?
This chapter is called Germany's Reaction Against the Jew. You can compare what is said here to various other sources. I think there are some inaccuracies here as far as specific claims that are made, but we'll discuss those when we get to them.
Okay, as I know. I know you feel that way, and you're going to talk about that. All right, well, you are the designated reader, so why don't you just start? Ladies and gentlemen, once again, we're in Chapter 2.
All right. Humanity has become wise enough to discuss these forms of physical sickness over which it formerly drew the veil of shame and secrecy, but political hygiene is not so far advanced. The main source of the sickness of the German national body is charged to be the influence of the Jews, and although this was apparent to acute minds years ago, it is now said to have gone so far as to be apparent to the least observing. The eruption has broken out on the surface of the body politic, and no further concealment of this fact is possible. It is the belief of all classes of the German people that the collapse which has come since the armistice and the revolution from which they are being prevented a recovery are the result of Jewish intrigue and purpose. They declare it with assurance. They offer a mass of facts to confirm it. They believe that history will provide the fullest proof.
Well, I have to stop right here because I've got some comments. You know, I found that a strong statement to say that it's the belief of all classes of the German people that the collapse and the problems and the revolution they had are the result of Jewish intrigue and purpose. I didn't know that all the German people were agreed on that. I thought it was kind of like with us here. Some people thought so and other people didn't, and depending on what political persuasion you were. So I'm just kind of asking, can this be true? Of course, they were really badly victimized. And I think the point he's making is that when they realized after the peace treaty, when they realized what had been done to them, then they woke up. But I don't know whether they all blamed the Jews or not. What do you
think? Well, it's always struck me when I was translating Alfred Rosenberg, how little he talked about Jews. Not as much as you would think, given the American perception of the Jews based on World War II propaganda. I mean, the American perception of National Socialist Germany.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about Jews, but not all the time. Even sometimes when there's a Jew that's mentioned by name, he won't point out that it's a Jew.
Well, was he talking about the betrayal and the what had happened to Germany when he didn't talk about the Jews that
you
much?
You see, the thing is that the politician that declared the Republic in 1918 was not a Jew. His name was Scheidemann. He was not a Jew.
Mm-hmm. But he was. I bet he was a Social Democrat.
Yeah, the Social
Democrats. And the Social Democrats were evil. I call them evil. The Social Democrats were, they were not, so much Democrats. They were socialist, and they were sympathetic with, they weren't communists. They didn't really like communism, but they were socialists. They had a whole different belief. They weren't really loyal Germans either, I don't think. They may have, some of them may have thought they were, but not like the nationalists were. They were more internationalist.
There was a division in the Social Democratic Party. Adolf Hitler himself originally had sympathy for the Social Democrats. Because he was opposed to the Habsburg monarchy, but also because the Social Democrats did try to assist poor people. But he was turned away from the Social Democrats by the fact that they were so hostile to nationalism, to German nationalism.
Mm-hmm. Right. Social Democrats were almost, they were so similar or so much on a par with the Jews as far as how damaging they were, in my opinion.
I wouldn't put it that way, because the guy that invented the term racial hygiene also was a Social Democrat. His name escapes me right now, but I have him on my blog. Basically, if National Socialism wasn't much of an option prior to 1919. So you had to choose between being a bourgeois nationalist, I suppose, or monarchist, or being a social democrat. It's not an easy choice if you're a poor person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened during the First World War is that the Social Democrats split, and the hard left faction that wanted to stop fighting the war formed the Independent Social Democratic Party.
Oh.
And there were lots of Jews in that faction, including famous names like Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg. And some of these people went on to become communists. There were lots of Jews. There's a list on Wikipedia of prominent names in the Independent Social Democratic Party, and about half of them are Jews that I know for sure.
Wow. Well, let's go on, and we can come back. We want to make sure that we get this whole chapter read. It's not a super long one or anything.
See, those are the people that Hitler had in mind when he was complaining about Jews undermining the war effort at home.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Well, like I was going to say, when we get finished, we can always come back to some of these points.
The Jew in Germany is regarded as only a guest of the people. He has offended by trying to turn himself into the host. There are no stronger contrasts in the world than the pure Germanic and the pure Semitic races. Therefore, there has been no harmony between the two in Germany. The German has regarded the Jew strictly as a guest, while the Jew, indignant at not being given the privileges of the nation family, has cherished animosity against his host. In other countries, the Jew is permitted to mix more readily with the people. He can amass his control unchallenged. But in Germany, the case was different. Therefore, the Jew hated the German people. Therefore, the countries of the world which were most dominated by the Jews showed the greatest hatred of Germany during the recent regrettable war.
Yeah, and those were what? Britain, the United States, Netherlands, Poland. Those are four, I would say.
Netherlands
had a lot
in the
of
war.
Jews.
Yeah, Netherlands.
Well,
was
no,
not
but
in
it
Britain.
Shows a lot of hatred. They weren't involved at all in World War One. Nothing.
Mm-mm. No, they were not invaded.
They were just neutral.
Yep.
Yeah.
They got bypassed.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Yeah, but the Jews definitely were powerful in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Jewish hands were in almost exclusive control of the engines of publicity by which public opinion concerning the German people was molded. The sole winners of the war were Jews.
Well, that's a strong statement, right?
the sole winners of the war were Jews.
That maybe is an overstatement.
I think almost everybody regretted it.
Regretted it except the Jews. So that isn't an overstatement then.
There were some French chauvinists that wished they could have really destroyed Germany completely, like Clemenceau.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe somebody else got something out of the war. Some of those Balkan countries got their independence.
Well, that's not real important.
The Polish nation came back into being. You could say the Poles were winners from the First World War.
Yeah, they were, from both of them.
But assertion is not enough. Proof is wanted. Therefore, consider the evidence. What occurred immediately upon the change from the old regime to the new? The cabinet composed of 6 men, which substituted the Minister of State, was dominated by the Jews Hase and Landsberg. Hase had control of foreign affairs. His assistant was the Jew Kautsky, a Czech. That grates on me. The Jew Kautsky, a Czech. He's either a Jew or he's a Czech. He can't be both. Who in 1918 was not even a German citizen. Also associated with Hase were the Jews Kohn and Herzfeld. The Jew Schiffer was financial minister of the state, assisted by the Jew Bernstein. The secretary of the interior was the Jew Preuss, with the Jew Dr. Freund for his assistant. The Jew Fritz Max Cohen, who was correspondent of the Frankfurter Zeitung in Copenhagen, was made government publicity agent.
The kingdom and this of, was after
okay,
the war?
What he's talking about right here is the period during which the Social Democrats and the Independent Social Democrats had their coalition government. It only lasted 2 months. I believe that's what he's talking about here. Kautsky, I think, went over with the Independent Social Democrats after the split.
Okay.
But some of the Jews stayed in the government. It ended up being mostly a non-Jewish non-Jewish social democrats dominating the government.
In Germany, you'd think it would be. I mean, they always use a figure sort of like under 1% of the population of Jews. So, you know, it's kind of hard to believe that they would actually.
Yeah. But these independent social democrats, you know, like Rosa Luxemburg and these other people, they continued to be a source of trouble.
Yes.
They ended up. By the way, you've heard about the Freikorps. The Freikorps were actually. I just ran across this fact. I didn't realize this. They were actually paid by the German government.
I kind of knew that they were supported by the German government. Right,
yeah.
they were like the new military for Germany after World War One or something
so
like this. I don't know.
You had the Freikorps being subsidized by the Social Democratic government to go around crushing communists. So I mean, there was some division there. It's not all one big conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the Kingdom of Prussia duplicated this condition of affairs. The Jews Hirsch and Rosenfeld dominated the cabinet, with Rosenfeld controlling the Department of Justice and Hirsch in the Department of the Interior. The Jew Simon was in charge of the Treasury Department. The Prussian Department of Justice was wholly manned and operated by Jews. The Director of Education was the Jew Furtran, with the assistance of the Jew Arndt. The Director of the Colonial Office was the Jew Meyer Gerhard. Well, that's a powerful position. They didn't have any colonies after that. The Jew Kastenberg was director of the Department of Art. The War Food Supply Department was directed by the Jew Wurm, while in the State Food Department were the Jews Professor Dr. Hirsch and the Geheimrat Dr. Stadthagen. The Soldiers and Workmen's Committee was directed by the Jew Cohen, with the Jews Stern, Hertz, Lovenberg, Frankl, Israelowitz, Laubenheim, Seligson, Katzenstein, Laufenberg, Heimann, Schlesinger, Merz, and Weil having control of various activities of that committee.
I love that name, Israelowitz. You know, that's unmistakable. But some of these names are just German names, like Merz. Because I have a friend who had his best friend who was killed in, they were comrades, you know, and his name was Eugen Merz, just a German. So, you know, they're a mixture. Some of their names you couldn't miss at all, but.
You know, a lot of these names that we take as typically Jewish, like Marx, actually are pretty common as non-Jewish names in Germany.
Wow. Yeah,
you hardly ever see that here, but in Germany, it's pretty common.
Wow, yeah. I don't know how the Jews could have been such a small amount of Germans, in a small number, proportion in Germany, and they're just everywhere, all over, doing everything. So, you know, what this shows is they got themselves into very influential positions that were important, key positions, just like they do here. Okay, mm-hmm. We better get going.
Okay, the Jew Ernst is chief of police at Berlin. In the same office at Frankfurt is the Jew Sinsheimer. In Munich, the Jew Steiner. In Essen, the Jew Levy. It will be remembered that the Jew Eisner was president of Bavaria, his financial minister being the Jew Jaffe. I just want to mention about Eisner. Apparently, Kurt Eisner, he had been one of those independent social democrats, but he was relatively moderate because he founded something called the Bavarian Volksstaat, the Bavarian People's State. It was not a Soviet republic under Eisner. It was what's called a people's state. And Gottfried Feder actually made a financial proposal to Eisner's government. He suggested that they should cancel interest, which was his pet theory about how to improve things. So Gottfried Feder is an original National Socialist, so Eisner must not have been totally poisonous. However, he was assassinated by somebody that had some Jewish ancestry and had been rejected for membership in a nationalist party because of his Jewish ancestry. Don't remember the name of that person. And after Eisner came the Soviet Republic of Bavaria. And that was when the Freikorps and remnants of the German army went in to get rid of that.
Okay.
Bavaria's trade...
Well,
you know, it frequently happens that you have some kind of moderate takeover, and then you get the extremists after that. It's a recurring pattern. Bavaria's trade, commerce, and industry were in control of the half-Jew Brentano. The Jews Lispinski and Schwarz were active in the government of Saxony. The Jews Thalheimer and Heimann in Württemberg. The Jew Fulda in Hessen. Two delegates sent to the peace conference were Jews, and a third was notoriously the tool of Jewish purposes.
Well, do you know how many delegates were sent? I was going to look that up, but...
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, there shouldn't have been any Jews sent to the peace conference. I mean, right? I mean, there shouldn't have been.
I always hear the story that there were Warburgs on both sides.
Huh, probably. Okay.
You know, because Wilson was practically a mental incompetent by the end of the war, and he had a lot of Jews in his administration as advisors anyway.
Yeah.
In addition, Jews swarmed through the German delegation as experts and advisors. Max Warburg, Dr. von Strauss, Merten, Oscar Oppenheimer, Dr. Jaffe, Deutsch, Brentenow, Bernstein, Struck, Rathenau, Wassermann, and Mendelssohn Bartholdy. As to the part which Jews from other countries had in the peace conference, German observers declare that any candid student may discover by reading the accounts of impartial non-Jewish recorders of that event. Only the non-Jewish historians seem to have been struck by the fact. The multitude of Jewish writers apparently judged it wise to conceal it.
The number of Jews there, yeah.
Jewish influence in German affairs came strongly to the front during the war. It came with all the directness and attack of a flying wedge, as if previously prepared. They probably did prepare. The Jews of Germany were not German patriots during the war, and although this will not appear as a crime in the eyes of the nations who were opposed to Germany, it may throw some light on the Jew's assertion of patriotic loyalty to the land where he lives. Thoughtful Germans hold that it is impossible for the Jew to be a patriot, for reasons which will presently be given. Now, you probably saw this story from this past week where Hitler's former commanding officer, who was a Jew, got some kind of exemption from Adolf Hitler because he had been a loyal soldier, and he was a judge after the war. But he had converted to Christianity, apparently was married to a non-Jewish woman. I'm not sure if exemptions like that were the exception or not. My understanding is that the Jewish war veterans did continue to receive, at least continued to receive their pensions under the Third Reich.
Yes, they did.
This is a bit of an depends on how narrowly you want to define the word patriot. There were Jews in the German military during the First World War that did what was expected of them, at least. We have to say that.
Yeah, well, let's go on because we're going to...
Right.
You want to talk about some other things later
just
on.
Just trying to be objective here.
I know.
The point to be considered is the general claim that the persons already named would not have obtained the positions in which they were found had it not been for the revolution. And the revolution would not have come had they not brought it. It is true that there were unsatisfactory conditions in Germany, but they could and would have been adjusted by the people themselves. The conditions which destroyed the people's morale and were made impossible of reform were in control of the Jews. The principal Jewish influences which are charged with bringing about the downfall of German order may be named under three heads. A, the spirit of Bolshevism, which masqueraded under the name of German socialism. B, Jewish ownership and control of the press. C, Jewish control of the food supply and the industrial machinery of the country. There was a fourth, higher up, but these worked upon the German people directly. I suppose the fourth higher up influence would be finance.
Yeah, they mentioned that later on. I don't remember. It was something like that. They tie it in, though.
Yeah. As it is possible that German conclusions upon this matter may be received doubtfully by peoples whose public opinion has been shaped by Jewish influence, as in the United States, it may help to quote George Pitter Wilson of the London Globe, who wrote early in April 1919, Bolshevism is the dispossession of the Christian nations of the world to such an extent that no capital will remain in the hands of the Christians, that all Jews may jointly hold the world in their hands and reign wherever they choose.
So George Pitner Wilson, or Pitter Wilson? He was a journalist, this says, of the London Globe.
Yeah, I tried to find something about him, and I didn't look very hard, but in my cursory search, I couldn't find anything.
Uh-huh. So he was obviously important then, but okay.
As early as the second year of the war, German Jews were preaching that Germany's defeat was necessary to the rise of the proletariat, at which time Strobel declared, I openly admit that a full victory of the country would not be in the interest of the Social Democrats.
Now, that's really a shocking statement. And I looked up Strobel, and he is a left-wing intellectual. That's the best way to describe him. His first name was Heinrich. So these left-wing intellectuals were talking like this. They did not want a victory. It wasn't going to give them the political situation they wanted. Because it the Kaiser would still be in power, and they wanted to overthrow the Kaiser. So, they were clearly, asking for defeat. And this is what Hitler and the National Socialists talked about later. They were absolutely right.
And these were the people that broke away from the Social Democrats and formed the Independent Social Democratic Party.
Okay, interesting.
Everywhere it was preached that the exaltation of the proletariat after a won victory is an impossibility. These instances, out of many, are cited not to reopen the military question, but to show how the so-called German Jew forgot loyalty to the country in which he lived and joined the outside Jews in accomplishing the collapse of Germany, and not merely, as we shall see, to rid Germany of militarism, which every thoughtful German desired, not sure if I accept that, but to throw the country into such confusion as to permit them to seize control.
Well, I think whenever you throw countries into confusion, or whenever, like, and this makes me think that it, I'm not real pleased that people think that if we let our country, the United States or any of these countries we're in now, fall apart, if these big disasters can happen, then we'll take control. Well, you know what? It's not going to be us that's taking control. They've already got that figured out, who's going to take control when that happens. So this is the wrong way of thinking, wouldn't you say? Collapse of nations and confusion and of everything falling apart like an anarchy, that never ends up in our interests.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think Jews really want total anarchy. I think what they want is a very loose society where they can call on the police.
Well, I'm not saying what they do or not, but I'm just saying that if it were to happen, I don't know that that would be good for us. Because it's usually of the left-wing elements that are, I guess in some cases it's the right-wing elements. Well, maybe I'm making a statement that's...
It tends to be somebody that promises to establish order and get people bred.
Or the people who already have the method. They already have, they're already in charge of all these, control of the country. And they have access to that. Like in our times, weaponry and so on. And the National Guard and the police and so on, they have control of all that. So they're the ones that can establish order.
Yeah,
that's kind of what I'm talking about. Well, let's go on.
Okay. The press of Germany echoed this plan of the Jewish spokesman, at first faintly, then boldly. The Berliner Tageblatt and the Münchener Neueste Nachrichten were, during the whole war, official and semi-official organs of the government. They were owned and controlled by Jews, as was also the Frankfurter Zeitung and a host of smaller papers that were their spiritual dependents. These papers, it is charged, were really German editions of the Jew-controlled press of the Allied countries, and their purpose was the same. Mm-hmm. One of the great pieces of research that ought to be undertaken for the purpose of showing the world how its thought is manufactured for it every day, and for what ulterior purposes, is this union of the Jewish press, which passes for the public press throughout the world.
Well, they make a big point of this in this chapter, and probably no doubt all the way through all the chapters, that the control of the press, which they used to call it, used to be called the press, now it's called the media, one of the main arms, of, along with finance, probably. What was the other one? But, press was one of two of the main arms of how Jews take control. So, yeah. And we see it. We're living with it. We know it. Well, now here they're going to talk about food.
And Dr. William Pierce had compiled Who Rules America in order to show that.
It was
almost every major media entity is controlled by Jews.
Right.
With almost no exceptions. The one exception that they like to point to recently is this guy that's the head of GE. Supposedly, I can't remember his name, but nobody knows if
he's Jewish or not.
Yeah, I could never find out if he was.
Yeah.
But his name was. Seems Jewish. Jeffrey Immelt.
Oh, yeah. Well, most people think Immelt is Jewish, but...
I would tend to think so.
Yeah.
They used to like to point to Ted Turner, and Ted Turner had a pretty significant media empire for a non-Jew, but then he got bought out.
Well, yes, he did, and they always do. And, you know, eventually you're going to sell to somebody, and it's always the Jews that are buying. So, everything eventually falls into their hands. Well, okay. Let's go on.
All right. The food and supplies of the people quickly passed into Jewish hands as soon as the war emergency came, and then began a period of dishonesty which destroyed the confidence of the bravest. Like all other patriotic people, the German people knew that war meant sacrifice and suffering, and like other people, they were willing to share the common lot. But they found themselves preyed upon by a class of Jews who had prepared everything to make profit out of the common distress. Immediately, Jews appeared in banks, war companies, distribution societies, and the ministries of supplies, wherever the life of the people could be speculated in or taxed. Articles that were plentiful disappeared, only to reappear again at high prices. The war companies were exclusively Jewish. And although the government attempted to regulate the outgo of food in the interests of all the people, it became notorious that those with money could get all of anything they wanted, regardless of the food cards. The Jews simply trebled the price of the goods they let go without the cards, and so kept a stream of the nation's gold flowing into their private treasuries. None of the government's estimates of the food stocks could be depended upon because of the hidden hoards on which these speculators drew. This began to disturb the morale of the people, and complaints were made and prosecutions started. But as soon as the cases came up, it was discovered that the prosecutor appointed to charge and the commissioner appointed to judge were also Jews. And so the cases usually wore themselves out without results. When, however, a German merchant was caught, great noise was made about it. And the penalty placed upon him was equal to what all the others should have had. Go the length and breadth of Germany today, say the reports, study the temper of the people, and you will discover that the abuse of power by the Jews has burned across Germany's memory like a hot iron.
Well, I like that. That's very passionate and good writing. That must be Cameron writing that, I guess, huh?
Yeah. It reminds me of... the stories of carpetbaggers coming to the South after the war between the states.
Well, that's right. And it really did make an impression on the Southerners that never went away. And I wonder if this, but I do doubt whether this, again, whether this was true about the Germans, because it seems like even, well, maybe, well, the National Socialists had a hard time, you know, getting themselves going. And if the people were so darn angry and fed up, you'd think they wouldn't have had... I think the Germans were, for the most part, still, while they secretly or in their own hearts didn't like the Jews and knew what the Jews had done, they were not as ready to outwardly condemn the Jews. There was some kind of fear of that that we are very familiar with, that the Southerners were not afraid of condemning the Yankees.
Well, you know, carpetbaggers weren't usually spoken of as Jews. But, I mean, there was that famous order that Ulysses Grant issued that Jews should be removed from all the occupied areas of the South, that they had to leave.
Well, they probably were Jews. That's right. A lot of them, they were Jews.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
It's exactly the kind of thing that they do.
Yes.
I do recall, however, that Hitler lamented that the Germans were not as anti-Semitic as the French.
Yeah, I mean, Germans have a problem accusing people in a collective way like that.
That mania for objectivity.
They just seem to have that. Too bad.
Okay. While these influences were undermining the mass of the people, higher influences of Jewish origin were operating upon the government. Higher influences of Jewish
origin. There they are. Yeah, those are those higher influences.
The advisors of the Bethmann Hollweg government were the great ship magnate Balin, a Jew, Theodor Wolff of the Berliner Tageblatt and a member of the pan-Jewish press, von Gwinner, director of the German bank who is connected by marriage with the great Jew bankers, the Spires, and Rathenau, the leader of Jewish industrial financial activities. These men were at the source of things and were bending the government as the other influences were bending the people. I just want to mention here, this is disputed by some people, but there is an Associated Press story from 1919 that appeared in the New York Times that mentions that Bethmann Hollweg himself was of Jewish descent.
Huh, that's interesting.
Some people deny that, and I, okay. You know, but it was in the Associated Press. That's not a fringe source.
Okay, I just want to let you know we've got less than 23 minutes left, so.
Okay. The rich German Jew could buy the recognition he desired by acquiring financial power over those interests which most directly affected the ruling class of Germany. But how was the poor Jew to gain the recognition he desired? For all Jews are actuated by the same desire. It is in them. They feel the spur to mastery. Having explored the conquest of the higher circles by Jewish money power, there is yet to explore the conquest of the body of the nation by Jews who had no money except what they could seize in the disorder which they caused. The analysis that is given follows. The Jew is not an anarchist. He is not a destructionist. All this is true, notwithstanding he is the world's Bolshevist and preeminently Germany's revolutionist. His anarchy is not ingrain. It is a device which he uses for a purpose. The rich Jew is not an anarchist because he can achieve what he desires by more subtle methods. The poor Jew has no other recourse. But rich and poor go jointly for a long stretch. The bond of sympathy between them never breaks. For if the anarchy is successful, then the poor Jew shall take his place with the rich Jew. And if the anarchy is not successful, it has nevertheless served to break up new fields in which the rich Jew may operate. In Germany, it was possible for the poor Jew to thrust himself up through the wall of Germanism above him only by breaking it up. In Russia, the same was true. The social system had encrusted around the Jew, keeping him in a position where, as the nations knew by experience, he would be less harmful. Mm-hmm. As nature insists the harmful foreign element in the flesh, building a wall around it, so nations have found it expedient to do with the Jew. In modern times, however, the Jew has found a means of knocking down the walls and throwing the whole national house into confusion, and in the darkness and riot that follows, seize the place that he has long coveted. When Russia broke, who came first to light? Kerensky, who is a Jew. But his plans were not radical enough, and then came Trotsky, another Jew. Trotsky found the system too strong for him to break in America. He broke through the weak spot in Russia and would extend that weakness around the world. Every commissar in Russia today is a Jew. Publicists are accustomed to speak of Russia as if it were in disorder. It may be that Russia is, but the Jewish government of Russia is not. From a mass of underlings, the Jews of Russia came up a perfect phalanx, a flying wedge through the super-induced disorder, as if every man's place had been previously prepared for him. All right, now he says every commissar in Russia today is a Jew. That's a gross overstatement.
Okay. I don't know how gross it is, but it's an overstatement.
Well, if you look at sources like Dennis Fahey or Robert Wilton, you get that the commissars were around 80%. Mm-hmm. 80% Jew. I can read a couple paragraphs here from Heinrich Hertle. I've translated.
Well, I wish we could. Let's wait till we get to the end, and then if we have time. You know, it's too bad we can't do this show however long it takes for each chapter, but we can't. We just
We've
can't
only got
set
three
it up
pages
that way.
To go, so.
Yeah. Well, okay, read that if you want to. If you think it'll help. But you said 80%. The point is, if it's that high, you could, you know, they're making it simple, as I said to you, for the general reader. They're not going into a lot of detail here when they say everyone was a Jew. Well, if 80%, it's close. So it's not like, yeah, it's an exaggeration. You should never say everyone is, because that's never true.
Yeah. The Bolsheviks had to take on some non-Jews because they could not have an all-Jewish government and get obedience from the people.
That's right.
There was an instance when Zinoviev and one of the other commissars went out to try to persuade some striking railroad workers to go back to work. And the railroad workers said, when they saw Zinoviev speak, they said, "Down with that Jew."
So, yeah, so they were doing, like when you say, when later on there were fewer Jews, you said they were probably putting these non-Jews up as front men. They were still doing the bidding of the Jews.
Okay, so here's what Heinrich Hertle wrote. He said, "The Central Committee of the Communist Party consisted of 12 members, of which 9 were Jews." This is according to Dennis Fahey that he's quoting, I think. "In the Council of the People's Commissars were found 17 Jews and 5 non-Jews. According to official information in 1920, out of 545 members of the Bolshevik administration, 447 were Jews. And that with a Jewish population of 7.8 million within a total population of 160 million.
Yeah, that's huge. That's incredible. You might as well say they were all Jews. I mean, what they really should say is that the Jews ran everything, rather than saying every commissar.
Well, you see, when you have a cohesive group in any organization, that cohesive faction tends to dominate.
Oh, sure.
Okay, here's a little more of Hertle. "The Jewish Chronicle of 6th January 1933, that's a bit later, but probably not as many Jews at that point, but he says, "The Jewish Chronicle reveals that in the Soviet Union, a third of the civil servants are Jews. That is a sixfold overrepresentation compared to non-Jewish civil servants. According to a statistic that was presented to the American Military Tribunal in 1947, the Supreme Soviet in the Crimea consisted of 50% Jews, and the People's Commissariat consisted of 40% Jews." And he gives figures for Jewish participation in the People's Commissariats, the school system, 80% Jews. Health system, 80% Jews. Economics, 80% Jews. Business, 60% Jews. Finances, 25% Jews. Justice, 30% Jews. NKVD, 45% Jews.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Lots of Jews.
Yeah. And I also have something here. There's a book. Let me pull this document up here.
Well, what's important here, I think. Okay, quickly.
Now, you can get... Now, just before the Bolshevik takeover, at the meeting where let me just read this. "On 23rd October 1917, the members of the Bolshevik Central Committee in attendance were Lenin, Zinoviev, Trotsky, Kamenev, Sverdlov, Kolontai, Uritsky, Sokolnikov, Dzerzhinsky, Stalin, Bubnov, Lomov." And the source for that is The Bolshevik Revolution, published by Stanford University Press. That's mostly Jews.
Yeah.
A couple of those are questionable. nobody.
But even really sure. Even the ones that are not actually Jews, they're in there with the Jews, and they probably think like. I mean, they go right along with the Jews.
Well,
I mean,
Dzerzhinsky they have joined supposedly, them. Supposedly Dzerzhinsky was fluent in Hebrew, but not a Jew. Supposedly,
yeah. There you go. So, well, they love Judaism. They might as well be.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that gets me here that is important that I see is the way they break through the ceiling. And what, like I said, it came like a flying wedge through the superinduced disorder. When you get enough disorder, they all of a sudden these kind of people come through and they're taking over. And this ceiling that they had to surround the keep the Jews in control, was to me kind of a vague anti-Semitism. It was a general anti-Semitism that used to exist everywhere. And that is what kept the Jews under this insisted, you know. But once that anti-Semitism was seen as something wrong and bad, which is what happened in Russia, actually, that's where it started, then they could come right through, and they started taking over. And they are harmful, and we have to see it that way.
Well, the containment of the Jews in Russia was more than just a matter of attitudes. There were laws that limited where they could live.
Oh yeah, sure. I'm thinking in terms of Europe, Western Europe. But anyway, up until the emancipation. Well, even after the emancipation, there was still in 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, there was still the idea, even though Jews were. There was no laws against anything, but like the idea that, well, Jews were not allowed in country clubs, they were not allowed in this group, they couldn't join that group. There was all kinds of people that just kept out Jews, and that was acceptable. Now it's not acceptable at all, and you see how everything has changed. Well, let's go back to the reading, and I won't interrupt anymore.
So he's talking about how... the Jews of Russia came up in a perfect phalanx as if their positions had been prepared for them. That also is the way it was in Germany. The German ceiling had to be broken, as it were, before the poor Jews could realize their ambition. When the break was made, they swarmed through and settled in places of control above the nation. This may explain why Jews the world over supply the energy of disruptive movements. It is understood that the young Jews of the United States are propagandists of an ideal that would practically abolish the United States. The attack is aimed, of course, against capitalism, which means the present government of the world by the Gentile. The true capitalists of the world are Jews, who are capitalists for capital's sake. It is hard to believe that they wish to destroy capital. They wish to obtain sole control of it, and their wish has long been in fair way to fulfillment. In Germany, therefore, as in Russia, distinction is made between the methods of the rich and of the poor Jews, because one method affects the government and the other the morale of the people. But both converge on the same objective. It is not only desire to escape oppression that actuates the lower classes of Jews, but desire to gain control. For the spirit of mastery pulses strong within them. German convictions on this question have reached the place where they may be expressed thus. Revolution is the expression of the Jews' will to power. Parties such as the socialists, democrats, and freethinkers are but tools for the Jewish plan to power. The so-called dictatorship of the proletariat is really and practically the dictatorship of Jews. So suddenly have German eyes been opened, so stormfully wrathful has been the reaction, that the word has gone out through German Judaism to retire to the second trench. There has been a sudden and concerted abandonment of office, wherever the office made direct contact with the public. There has, however, been no abandonment of power. What will happen in Germany is not now known. Some regrettable things have already happened. But the Germans will doubtless prove themselves equal to the situation by devising methods of control at once unobjectionable and effective. But as to Russia, it is hardly doubtful any longer what will happen there. When Russia turns, a shudder will run through the earth.
Now, what does he mean that Russia hasn't turned yet? Well, this is 1920. It has turned.
I think at that time it was appearing that the Bolsheviks were going to fail.
Okay. And so the turn is what?
Turning against the Jews.
Oh, and a shudder will run through the earth. Huh. Okay. Yeah. Very poetic.
See, the Germans will handle this thing in a way that's unobjectionable and effective. The Russians will do it in some objectionable way, apparently.
Yeah.
That's what
maybe with lots of bloodshed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where the word pogrom comes from. Mm-hmm. How Gentile Germany and Russia look at the entire question may be summarized as follows. Judaism is the most closely organized power on earth, even more than the British Empire. It forms a state whose citizens are unconditionally loyal, wherever they may be, and whether rich or poor. The name which is given in Germany to this state, which circulates among all the states, is All-Judaan. The means of power of the state of All-Judaan are capital and journalism, or money and propaganda. All-Judaan is the only state that exercises world government. All the other states can and may exercise national government only. The principal culture of All-Judaan is journalistic.
There you go. See?
The technical, scientific, literary performances of the modern Jew are throughout journalistic performances. They are due to the marvelous talent of the Jews for receptivity of others' ideas. Capital and journalism are joined in the press to create a political and spiritual medium of Jewish power. The government of this state of All-Judaan is wonderfully organized. Paris was its first seat, but has now been moved to third place.
You know, I'm taking that as meaning Napoleon in the French Revolution, when the Jews were really in control in France, especially in Paris, and carried all that out. And now, but then they moved on. Okay. Just want to throw that in there.
Yeah. Before the war, London was its first and New York its second capital. It remains to be seen whether New York will now supplant London. The drift is toward America. And it certainly did, actually.
Yes.
I'm a little bit skeptical about this portrait of the cohesive worldwide Jewish state. If he were only talking about Jewish banking or banking in general, I would find it more agreeable. But I don't think that every Jewish faction is in a conscious conspiracy with every other.
Well, I don't know that they're saying that. They're just saying that there is an All-Judan or All-Judan government or state. It doesn't mean that every Jew and so on is participating knowledgeably in it. But why don't we continue reading this, and that, because it closes off with this, and then you can talk about this whole idea that he has of All-Judan.
As All-Judan is not in a position to have a standing army and navy, other states supply these for it. Its fleet is the British fleet, which guards from hindrance the progress of all Jewish world economy, or that part of it which depends on the sea. In return, All-Judan assures Britain an undisturbed political and territorial world rule. All-Judan has added Palestine to British control. Wherever there was an All-Judan land force, whatever national uniform it might wear, it worked with the British Navy. All-Judan is willing to entrust the government of various strips of the world to the nationalistic governments. It only asks to control the governments. Judaism is passionately in favor of perpetuating nationalistic divisions for the Gentile world. For themselves, Jews never become assimilated with any nations. They are a separate people, always were and always will be. all Udon's only quarrel with any nation occurs when that nation makes it impossible for all Udon to control that nation's industrial and financial profits. It can make war, it can make peace, it can command anarchy in stubborn cases, it can restore order. It holds the sinews of world power in its hand, and it apportions them among the nations in such ways as will best support all Udon's plan. Controlling the world's sources of news, all Udon can always prepare the minds of the people for its next move. The greatest exposure yet to be made is the way that news is manufactured and the way in which the mind of whole nations is molded for a purpose. When the powerful Jew is at last traced and his hand revealed, then comes the ready cry of persecution, and it echoes through the world press. The real causes of the persecution, which is the oppression of the people by the financial practices of the Jews, are never given publicly.
Publicity.
Oh, publicity. Never given publicity.
Yeah.
All Udon has its vice governments in London and New York. Having wreaked its revenge on Germany, it will now go forth to conquer other nations. Britain it already has. Russia it is struggling for, but the chances are against it. The United States, with its good-natured tolerance of all races, offers a promising field. The scene of operations changes, but the Jew is the same throughout the centuries.
A fantastic chapter, and you read it so well. Now, I have to comment here that that he says, having wreaked its revenge on Germany, it will now go forth to conquer other nations. Well, it wasn't done with Germany, was it? This was 1920, so it remained with its revenge pointed at Germany, and then it went on to do much worse things. So this is, I think this is very good. Really shows us. It's just to think that they had the wherewithal. The perspective or the wherewithal, those are not the right words, but to write all this, to understand all this and to see it. And I don't think you can find fault with some of the way some of the sentences are written, maybe too strongly, but basically it's right on.
Well, the main problem here is a certain amount of oversimplification.
Well, sometimes you have to, maybe, to get the point across. I don't know.
And it was also not easy to get accurate information back at that time.
Yeah, you made that point. That's a good point. It's easier today. We have much more information at our disposal, and it was not. They had to do all this investigating to even get this much. What's your final word? We've only got a few seconds.
Well, it says the United States, with its good-natured tolerance of all races, offers a promising field. What is the big golem for world Jewry today? It's the United States military.
Oh.
Which the United States spends way more money on military than any other country in the world, and we are their bully boy. They have ended up controlling the United States and using it as their source of power, but the United States is being ruined by them right now.
Okay, and this is the end of our program, ladies and gentlemen. This has been Carolyn Yeager and Hadding Scott bringing you episode 3. Tune in next week for episode 4. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.